Fantastic. One thing the Shakespeare Institute has always delivered is very hard acts to follow. And, one keeps at it. I think our only hope of following Reg and John Russell Brown is with Stanley and John, who I hope will surrender themselves to the personal bugging process to my left forthwith. I did think that I might set about introducing you to who Stanley Wells is, and then I thought, if you need telling who Stanley Wells is, I hope you have a lovely time on this planet while you're here. I think it was 7 honorary doctorates at the last count, all the books in your libraries. John Jowett had the great good fortune to work with Stanley on the most important Shakespeare editorial project of the later 20th century, the Oxford Shakespeare, and indeed has taken over the running of the new Oxford Shakespeare, the Oxford Shakespeare taken forward into an age of digitization and multiple versions and all sorts of wonderful things, which he's going to tell us about the minute he has a microphone attached to him. John Jowett is, of course, Deputy Director of the Institute, and as we've heard, one of the first things that started happening in this institution when it was set up was the editing of plays, the thinking of how to present the texts, the thinking of what those texts represented in relation to performance. And that's something which John and Stanley have carried forward in the most spectacular ways. And they will now interview each other all about it. Thank you.
Well, Stanley, thank you for being here. Not that you are ever very far away. Certainly one of the people who has had a long association with this place and never in any meaningful sense left.
Can I tell you how I first got here?
Well, yes, do that. Yes, certainly.
Well, it was a funny story because I was at school in Hull and then I went to University College in London. And then I drifted. I've always drifted all my life. And I drifted into a school teaching job in Hampshire. And during that time, I kept up my reading on Shakespeare, partly by reading Shakespeare's Survey. And I was very ill paid in that job in Hampshire. I think my salary was £250 a year when I left. And I couldn't afford holidays. So I decided my former professor at University College was Charles Sisson, C.J. Sisson. And Sisson had come here as a senior research fellow. And so I knew vaguely about the Shakespeare Institute. I knew it existed, at least. And at college, I'd done paleography. I'd done handwriting with Sisson and his loyal assistant, Miss Husbands, Winifred Husbands. And so I thought, well, to give myself a bit of a holiday without actually paying very much for it, I'd offer myself as a volunteer. So I did. I wrote to the Institute and said, would they like any help, perhaps in transcribing documents with my paleographic background? I had a reply saying, OK, come. So I came and stayed here for a couple of weeks and saw some plays, including, the Dorothy Tutin Twelfth Night, which I saw about 12 times. And I, at the end of that period, the end of that couple of weeks, Allardyce, who had been on holiday, came back and said, would you like to apply for a scholarship? There was a benefactor, wasn't there? Oliver King. And Oliver King, I think, had given some money, which enabled them to give me £250 a year as a scholarship. So I lived in 3 Chestnut Walk for 3 years with an extraordinary landlady called Miss Gibbs. I could go on about her quite a bit. The stories she used to tell about Barry Corelli were nobody's business, about how when Bertha, her companion, got into the carriage, it subsided on her side. And how Murray Corelli went to the church on Shakespeare's birthday, but not with the procession. At the end of the day, she walked sadly down to the church, carrying a wreath on which was written, "From She Who Understands." So at the end of that 2 weeks here, as I say, Allardyce said, would I like to apply for scholarship? I did. He gave it to me. And so I started. One had to register first for an MA in those days. And I started, and on editorial work, in fact, and I could talk a bit, if you wanted, about the editions that we were doing then. What I edited for my PhD was two pamphlets by Robert Greene, pretty bad, pretty boring, Perimedes the Blacksmith, and more importantly, Pandoster, the Source of the Winter's Tale. I was supervised for those, partly by Norman Sanders, who was a considerable editor and textual scholar, partly by Mr. Shapiro, whom we all miss, a great scholar, a great figure, a great character. Ship was the sort of person who was almost determined not to let you finish your PhD because he had such a meticulous eye for detail. But eventually Allardyce circumvented that by saying, well, I think it's okay, put it in, bug it in, so I did. But the Green edition is a story on its own, too. We were Allardyce, Nicol, and a man from University of Alabama, what was his name, were appointed editors of that. It never came to anything except that if in the Institute Library there are a number of dissertations of editions of Robert Greene. Mine was eventually published by Garland in a really disgraceful edition, photocopied badly from the typescript that we used in those days. So that was how it started for me anyway.
Yes, and I'm becoming aware, you know, as I'm listening to you, C.J. Sissons was a major Shakespeare editor, and then when you came here, you were coming into an environment where textual editing was central to the activities. And I was thinking about my own background and the way that I always feel that editing is such a central, foundational thing for the study of Shakespeare. And then I thought, well, I would think like that because as an undergraduate I was taught by Ernst Honigman from the Shakespeare Institute, and then I was supervised by Philip Edwards for my PhD. He also had a spell here, I think.
So yes, I think he wasn't actually a fellow, but he was associated with the Institute from Birmingham, sort of seconded, as it were.
Yes.
Yes, and he's still with us, or not quite, but I mean not physically, but literally, yeah.
And so, yes, and so I ended up editing with him, and I'd already got that sense of value that was ultimately coming from the Shakespeare Institute, I would say.
I must say that I think that editing, and I encouraged it when I was director here, is a very valuable training for a scholar in the early modern period, because it takes you into so many different areas. Bibliography, paleography is desirable, theatre history is highly desirable, as John said, the history of criticism, it tests your critical abilities, the bibliographical side of it. So I think it gives you a wonderfully wide range of training, which is part of why I went on encouraging people to do it when I was here.
Yes, and of course you yourself are associated with a style of editions that's bringing performance more into the picture, which I suppose began with
the
Penguin edition.
Well, John is one of the great pioneers on that, but we tried it with the Penguin. I could talk a lot, of course, about Terence Spencer and about the founding of the Penguin edition from here, with which I was deeply involved, all the long discussions we had, hours and hours deciding whether to put the notes at the back or at the foot of the page. I'm glad we decided in the end to put them at the back, because now the Penguin is the only reputable English edition which you can read, and actors find it very useful, I think, to have a clean page as well. So that was a good thing.
Edition of single plays. I mean, there is the complete works of Shakespeare.
Oh, well, there is that as well, yes, yeah. Well, that all started with Lentil Soup. I was working here, I was a reader by that time, and a senior editor at Oxford came across and wanted to make. I'd done a few things for them, bibliographical guides and so on, and he asked if I'd like to. He came and saw us, and we gave him Lentil Soup for lunch. And he said, would I like to edit a complete Oxford Shakespeare? So that was what took me away from the Institute for about 9 years, till I'd worked myself out of that job. And luckily, this job, the directorship here, became vacant at just the right time for me. Mm.
And yet it seems to me that the Oxford Shakespeare grows out of your years here and the kind of thing that
it
you were
does.
Doing in the
it
Penguin
does.
Shakespeare.
It does, absolutely. And the kind of theatre-going I was doing here, too. Because I wrote about theatre quite a lot, and I followed in John's footsteps in that way, And in editing, I always tried to be highly conscious of how the plays would go in the theatre. Mm. Of course, when I was at Oxford, I was lucky enough to get you as one of the editors on the edition, and that was how we came together and developed the Oxford edition.
Yes, which was the crucial point in my career, certainly. You know, it cemented me in as a textual editor and ultimately led to me coming here.
Yeah, I remember Ernst Honigman writing a reference for you and saying, fine, spelling's not very good.
I was hoping you wouldn't mention that.
Please, I can't.
I rely on the spell checker a lot, of course. It's different these days.
So do you want to tell us about how the new Oxford Shakespeare is developing? Now, you see, we did the big one. We did it, Gary and I. Of course, when we started, we worked on Olivetti's. You know, I had a little portable Olivetti, which I got as an undergraduate, and that was how I started editing the complete works. We didn't have personal computers in those days. And people sometimes forget this, I think, when they're sort of judging the edition. It was a time of great development in textual studies, which was... So the whole textual scene, as you will remember, was changing while we were editing. So in a way, some of our texts went out of date before we got the complete works done. But at least we did get it done.
Yes, and of course, you know, we were writing the commentaries on index cards.
Yes, yeah.
Which we still have and are going to be used for the new Oxford Shakespeare, because they were never published in the original one. But on the other hand, we started using computer text, didn't we? Computer printouts.
We
we were actually marking up computer
because Howard Hill, printouts. Trevor Howard Hill, had done the concordances to each individual work, and those had been 5 times checked, I believe, and we did have access to those from a central computer, not from our personal computers, and we worked partly on the printouts from those.
Mm. And the connection I'd make is that as a result of that, the original Oxford Shakespeare was one of the earliest electronic editions. We don't think of it as being an electronic edition, but it was actually published on floppy disks. A drive floppy disks. It had all the tagging in it, and it wasn't its primary manifestation, and it wasn't the intention behind it.
No.
But it was already doing that in the mid 1980s, and I can't think of any comparable edition in that respect. Under recognised claim to fame for the edition, maybe.
Yeah, my great regret about the Oxford edition is that they never printed our texts in single volumes. Because I think we were working for actors in many ways. We were trying to punctuate for actors, we were trying to write stage directions for actors, and that edition is very unsuitable for theatrical use. Nobody wants to lug around a complete works in the rehearsal room. And I did try to persuade them to do that, but they never did.
Mm. How do you feel about the editorial stage directions that we were doing in the Oxford Shakespeare?
Well, you know, in a way, other people ought to judge them, but I think we did our best to allow for openness and flexibility. Mm. We devised that not ideal system of broken brackets, which we used to indicate that a stage direction was a possibility but not a necessity. Mm. That, you know, for example, when in the Porter scene in Macbeth, you're not sure whether the porter finishes his speech and there's no exit for him. You don't know whether he should go out after he's finished speaking or at the end of the scene. So we put, I've forgotten where we put it now, but we put it somewhere with the indication that you needn't have it at that particular place. But we did try to work towards flexibility and to not to be over dogmatic, I think, don't you think?
I think so, yes. And I think the challenge is that there was no commentary being published with it. There was no space for us to actually explain.
Yeah, that's the regrettable thing. Mm. Again, we did our cards. I don't think you should ever edit anything without doing a commentary on it. I felt that when I was at first editing, one of my first serious editing jobs was a Shoemaker's Holiday for Revels, which I edited along with Robert Smallwood. And in doing that, I had to use the Friends and Bowers edition. And Bowers didn't have a commentary at that stage. It was later done by Sarah Soy. And I felt that he'd missed quite a lot of textual problems because he hadn't been having to explain the text. Mm. So that was one of the reasons why I insisted when we started the edition. I started just by myself and then got Gary and then got you and then Bill Montgomery. That was why I insisted that we should get the... sorry, I've lost my sentence. The
commentaries?
Be doing the commentaries while we were doing it. It was the sadness that they were not printed with the edition. That was because America got cold feet. The American publishers decided they couldn't compete. They were going to do the annotated edition, but they decided they couldn't compete with, I think it was Norton at the time, which Charlton Hinman was doing an edition which never came to anything, and his wife took it over, and that never came to anything. And the press sadly sold all our commentaries to Norton to use in their edition. We've just managed more or less to get them back. They were mouldering away in the vaults at OUP, and are now mouldering away in my office here. But they are gradually being typed up, and we're hoping that they'll be of use to you and Gary in the third edition of the Oxford Shakespeare.
Yes, and there are boxes in my office too, yeah, and sure, the library here is helping with the digitisation of those commentaries. And it's very strange to see one's own handwriting from back then and to sort of start getting back into the mental space you were when you wrote those notes. But I agree completely that editing should be accompanied with writing of commentary, because that really makes editing an act of close reading. And I was saying to one of our guests earlier that it seems to me that something that editing shares with acting is that it's a form of close reading where the meaning and the weight of every single word has to be contemplated in order to achieve the act properly. Mm. It's really one of the reasons why I'm very enthusiastic about the new Oxford, is that it does give the opportunity for those commentaries to appear, for commentaries to appear, really fulfil something that we were doing back then.
Yeah, and of course, along with the complete works, I was generally editing the multi-volume Oxford Shakespeare, and for that, I felt it was necessary to give editors their head. I was commissioning separate editors for those, so I thought it would be quite wrong to impose. I mean, although I gave guidance and recommendations, I didn't finally say, you've got to, for example, I allowed Michael Neal, to his current regret, I think, a bit, to spell Anthony in Anthony Cleopatra with an H in it. I couldn't persuade Alan Brissenden to spell Arden the way I spelled it in the complete works as Arden. Alan was more conservative than I was about that, but I'm still glad I did. Nobody agrees with me, but I'm glad I did. Because I think it's right. Right-ish, anyway. And of course, you've made some very distinguished contributions to that multi-volume edition. The Richard III and the Time in which you've done are among, I think, the very best textual editions available anywhere. And I was delighted this year when Richard II finally appeared after various vicissitudes, and that edition, the multi-volume Oxford Shakespeare, is now complete. Give and take the, you know, with Edward III, which we forget about. But after all, there are several other apocryphal plays, which are... And you, well, as you yourself are such an expert on collaboration, we know that the canon is gradually expanding with study of Shakespearean collaboration. As you've written yourself recently, Arden of Faversham is now where Edward III was
about indeed.
20 years ago, I
suppose. And people are seriously arguing that Shakespeare had a hand in the additions to the Spanish tragedy.
Arden did that 20-odd years ago.
But yeah, but it's been around for a while, but I think the basis for it is a lot firmer now, and is one of the things that we can actually do using computers to do the computational stylistics to look into that. And of course, you know, with the other thing to say about the new Oxford is that it's very much going in that direction of being a fully-fledged digital edition, as well as being a print edition, and being actually designed to be that from the ground up, and I think that gives a kind of sense of purpose. You know, that this will be a complete works that is for the digital age, as well as the print age that we still inhabit, as well as on top of the digital age that's coming in.
How are we doing for time, Michael?
Oh, rubbish.
There we are. So you've just seen the two best editors in the world being incredibly clumsily edited, in live performance.